From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Labor is ending the year in the box seat for the election to come. Its long-term lead in the polls has actually increased since the change of Prime Minister. But as it gets closer to a prospective victory, the pressure on it from the government has intensified, especially on the issues of asylum seekers and industrial relations. This weekend, Labor starts its three-day national conference, a conference that carries more weight than its Liberal counterpart because it sets a platform supposedly binding on ALP MPs. Labor will be making every effort to downplay any division and to showcase a party machine focused on winning government. Today we're speaking with Anthony Albanese, Shadow Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Cities and Regional Development, and we're canvassing what lies ahead. Anthony Albanese, elections are always unpredictable. For example, in 1993, it seemed right to the end that the Liberals were assert to win, and they didn't. Are you nervous about this one, and what could go wrong for Labor now? What are the main challenges for you in the months ahead?
Well, elections, of course, are always unpredictable. And the truth is that all the polls indicate that we're ahead. But when you look at the polls, even a 55-45 split means that five people out of every 100 who at this stage, at this point in the cycle, were going to vote Labor, change their mind, and all of a sudden it's back to 50-50. The other thing is that if you look historically, governments have always come back during election campaigns. Governments have the advantage of incumbency. I think this time around as well, the coalition strategy is to bring down a budget in April, use all of the bureaucracy to achieve policy outcomes that set up a framework. It's in a context of an economy that is growing and therefore, particularly with increased revenues, will allow the government to be generous in terms of its approach to funding of essential activities as they see it, and to make election commitments that are funded in that budget. And the government will avoid scrutiny through processes like the Senate estimates, which is due to meet 2 weeks after the budget. I predict that by then the election will have been called. So
it has been brought forward, though, that Senate estimates process, so there will be a quick and dirty investigation, if you like.
I think what we'll see is the Prime Minister go to the Governor-General on the Sunday after the budget. That's my prediction for an election on either May 11 or May 18. And it's simply not possible to have the same level of scrutiny that you normally have through the Senate estimates process. And what we've seen also increasingly is governments making decisions that are included in the budget but not announced. So there's a possibility that that will happen as well. We saw the revelations, for example, in my portfolio of infrastructure commitments for the Mackay Ring Road, other projects on the Bruce Highway, for higher speed rail, for a range of infrastructure projects around the country, with that being leaked after the Malcolm Turnbull coup against him, and those announcements, sure enough, being rolled out over the subsequent months. So I think there is an advantage for the government. And historically, I can't recall any election in which the government hasn't gone forward during the election campaign, with the exception of 2010, where you had, of course, a very newly installed Prime Minister in Julia Gillard.
But, of course, the money in the budget is available to you also to make promises with. So there can be unpredictability on both sides.
That is correct. And we have also made decisions about revenue that will produce a benefit in later years, more so than in the initial stages. So decisions, for example, about the imputation issue of dividends, that costs the budget around about $5 billion this year, but that rises to $8 billion over the forwards. And of course, across a 10-year period, rises by substantially more than that. So those tough decisions that we've made mean that Labor will be in a position to fulfil the commitments that we've made and that we will make, and also, I think, be in a stronger fiscal position, we hope to be, than what the government is offering at the time of the election.
But those policies like that and negative gearing, are open to a big scare campaign. We've already seen some of this, but it'll be ramped up in the election with two-word slogans like retirement tax.
Yeah, there's no doubt that will occur, and that is a benefit that the government has, and that's why it's always a risk to put out a policy so far in advance. But you have to look at the opportunity cost, I guess. What is the risk of not announcing policy is that the government will be in a position of just making things up, whereas by putting out the policies, by being transparent and by arguing the case for them very early, I think it restricts the capacity of the government to be able to run a scare campaign about the alleged impact of those policies. And I think that the Australian people will mark us up for the fact that we've been prepared to be transparent and to put out some policies which are bold and which, of course, is taking a risk. I think that people are looking for honesty and integrity in politics, and one of the things that we have done across the board in terms of policy development is make early announcements, whether that be on tax issues or whether it be on a range of issues. In my portfolio, we have made substantial announcements in tourism, in major infrastructure projects, in the sort of structures that we would set up, establishing city partnerships, re-establishing the major cities unit, what we would do with Infrastructure Australia. The feedback I get from the business community and from the general public is that they're supportive of political parties being prepared to argue for their policies and do it in a transparent way.
One of the features, of course, of this term has been Labor's lead in the polls, a consistent lead. And another feature has been the low ratings of Bill Shorten in the polls. Why do you think your leader is so unpopular, and does it matter in the election?
Well, I'm not a commentator, I'm a participant. And I think the important figures are whether the Labor team and the Labor Party, the alternative government, is seen as being worthy of election. And the polls have shown for some period of time now that if an election was held, then Labor would be successful. I do think that the government, the coalition parties, made an extraordinary mistake in removing Malcolm Turnbull. Because I think at that point in time, 49% for some of the reasons I've given and historical analysis showing the advantage that an incumbent government has going into an election campaign, the fact that the coalition was on 49% and on the rise combined with Malcolm Turnbull winning 58 news polls in a row as preferred Prime Minister, mean that I think the election was very much 50-50, whereas now I think any honest and fair assessment has us as the favourites. But we, of course, are subject to the actual election campaign and to people putting a number one next to Labor candidates. I do think that one of the things that happens and the reason why the government comes back during an election campaign is that people, when they're not in an election period, are more inclined to vote for an opposition and indeed more inclined to vote for minor parties or to suggest they're going to if they have any gripe with the government. Now, making an actual assessment of who they want to govern the country or who they want to represent them as their local member is very different to that. And that's why I think polling has proven to be inaccurate in a number of cases. And the last example we saw of that was just a couple of weeks ago, whereby Daniel Andrews' government was returned with a vote that was higher than any of the polls were predicting. And they won seats that no one was predicting Labor would win, such as the blue ribbon seat of Hawthorne.
Now, just going back to last week's chaotic events, Peter Dutton made it clear today that the government will be very selective in what changes it will be willing to make to the encryption bill. Was Labor wise, when you look at it in retrospect, to let that bill through last week without pushing to get amendments which it says are necessary?
Well, that was a decision that was made by the leadership group.
Were you involved?
No, I wasn't. I had left. I had left Canberra because Parliament had stopped in terms of the House of Representatives.
So was it wrong?
I must say, no. I think it was a decision based upon a view that they didn't want to be in a position whereby if there was an incident, then the argument could be put that Labor should have supported that legislation, that the intervention on encryptions were necessary. Now, I wasn't also, I'm not on the National Security Committee, I wasn't subject to the briefings that may have been given to people on that committee. So I'm not in a position to comment on that. But I backed the judgment of Bill Shorten and others who made that decision.
Reluctantly, perhaps, you backed that judgment.
Well, I'm not privy to the information that they had. They had to make the call, and of course, commitments were given in good faith and stated publicly in the Parliament by the Senate leader that there would be a process to consider the amendments that Labor believed were required to that legislation. And Matthias Cormann, I accept in good faith that those commitments have been made, and one would expect that they would be honoured. It's not surprising that Peter Dutton, who I don't regard as someone of integrity, would be prepared to try and play politics with these issues. But one of the things Labor has done is to try to take the politics out of national security, and that's as it should be. We shouldn't be looking for partisan political advantage on these issues. There should be only one concern, which is the national interest and keeping Australians safe.
Now, turning to the National Conference, what will be the main areas of debate, do you think?
Look, I think one of the things that I, and I'm sure you may well agree, as a long-time observer as well of our national conference process. I've been a delegate to every ALP national conference since 1986, so I suspect that I'm the longest-serving delegate at the conference. And, of course, in those days, the conferences were much smaller, had 99 delegates in those days when I represented Young Labor at my first conference. One of the things that has been consistent, though, and I make this prediction, the big issue at conference next week, we will not know today what it is. Inevitably, there is an issue that comes from left field that attracts a lot of attention.
Literally.
Well, literally, perhaps, yes. But given the nature of the party and its breaking up of some of the traditional factional alignments, it could come from anywhere. I think that the Labor Party has changed in some of its power structures so that there are groups of unions, for example, who cooperate across factional lines. And
well, notably the CFMEU.
That's right, but it does, but so do some other unions as well, and we're seeing some of that occur, whereas traditionally what you would have is the left unions have a position and the right unions have a position. What we've seen emerge over the years is often the unions have a position and the parliamentary party have a different disposition when it comes to determining policy outcomes. So we'll see how that plays out. I should imagine it will be a very constructive conference. People will have in mind that we are on the verge of an election being called, perhaps as early as late January is one possibility that people will have in mind. It's also the case because a lot of the hard work was done, bearing in mind that the National Conference was due to be held in July, much earlier this year. Many issues have been talked through and worked through and finalised a long time ago. So I think on that basis, I see that there will be less conflict than there's been from time to time in the past. But when you have 400 people who are passionate about policy development and who have different perspectives on what Labor should do in government, I think it's a good thing that we're prepared to be transparent and have these debates out there in the open for 3 days. And we'll be stronger as an organisation for that.
Now, obviously, attention will be on asylum seeker policy. You voted against Turnbank's last conference. You think there won't be a vote this time. But regardless of that, what is your view on this Turnbank issue now?
Well, my view is that we have a comprehensive policy. There's a focus from the Australian newspaper in particular about this issue without looking at the context at all. And the context here is that Labor has a framework which is aimed at not having any boats which need to be stopped, on having regional processing, on having increased funding for the UNHCR, on having an increased intake of a doubling of the number of refugees who would be settled. So the ideal is that people aren't risking their lives by getting on boats to try to come to Australia, and that we have an orderly process which involves regional cooperation, which involves and integrates the UNHCR in those processes.
But as you said, that is the ideal. In practice, a Labor government is likely to be tested in its early stages by some boats. Are you willing now to accept a turn-back policy? And how
well,
do
that's
you...
That is the platform of the Labor Party, and that was adopted at the last national conference. There isn't a debate within the Labor Party about that issue foremost. What there's a debate about is how people on Nauru and Manus can be settled in third countries, or those who need medical assistance, how we can deal with that, how we can cooperate with regional processing. That's what the focus is on. The focus in the media on that issue does not reflect the internal debates in the Labor Party, and that might be inconvenient for the Australian, which seems to run this on the front page each day, but it is a different world from the world that's actually inhabited by people in the Labor Party and by people who are concerned about these issues. And the principle that I've espoused, consistently, I didn't actually speak at the last national conference on any of these issues, in spite of some of the reporting which would suggest that I did. But the principle I've espoused in a range of speeches and in Parliament over many years is that you can be tough on people smugglers without being weak on humanity. And what that means in practice is that we need to make sure that people aren't risking their lives by getting on boats. But that doesn't mean that we should ignore our international obligations as good international citizens. And that means that essentially a range of the policies which have been put in place by the current government will remain. But that's not where the story ends, because the problem for this government, of course, is that they haven't solved the problem after now more than 5 years of people being in detention in circumstances which all of the medical advice and, quite frankly, common sense tells you is causing anguish and mental health issues, as well as, from time to time, physical health issues for people on Manus and Nauru.
Well, you had the numbers the other day to pass that amendment that would have facilitated bringing people here for medical treatment, and of course in the end it didn't get to the House. But it would be due to the House in February, assuming the Parliament does come back. Do you think you will retain those crossbench numbers when that vote comes up, or will a couple slip away?
Oh, I think that the crossbench members are committed to a common sense humanitarian position, and you know we're a good country, and we're good enough to say that when a doctor is saying that a child is exhibiting symptoms of a syndrome, essentially of shutting themselves down.
We'll be talking about adults, though. The children will be off by that stage. They're nearly off now.
Well, we'll wait and see. Remember, the children were going to be off by now, and they're not. And remember that this is a government that said that it would solve the issue on Manus and Nauru, and more than 5 years later, they haven't. Remember that this is a government that trumpeted the agreement with the United States, and that process is taking a very long time indeed. And remember that this is a government that has ignored the offer of New Zealand, in spite of the fact that somehow its logic seems to be that people would be attracted to getting into Australia through New Zealand, but that the United States somehow is not an attractive destination for someone who has been found to be a refugee and has therefore fled from persecution and fear of physical harm or indeed of their life. That sort of logic is absurd, particularly when the government has used the excuse of the particular arrangements that exist between Australia and New Zealand in terms of travel. But the truth is that it is open to the immigration minister right now to refuse to allow people from New Zealand to come to Australia. So it is really a position whereby it would appear that the government has consciously not solved these problems when the solutions have been available to it for some time.
Would a Labor government try to increase the number of people that New Zealand would take? It's only 150 or so a year. That would be one logical course, you'd think.
Well, that would be a very logical course, and one
and
could.
And you do it?
It's a hypothetical question. We'll deal with the circumstances at the time. But the truth is that this offer was made years ago. So it had it been accepted, it wouldn't be 150. It would be at least 600.
A case you could put to New Zealand, surely.
Could have been settled. Well, it's not up to me to put that case at this point in time. We'll address things under the circumstances in which we find them, but we'll address them in a practical way that ensures that we have an orderly migration program, but that we have one that's consistent with our international obligations and is one which is consistent with the principle that I've espoused, which is tough on people smugglers, but without being weak on humanity and without giving up our national soul.
Isn't Labor's problem in this area that some voters will say, well, they say all these things, but can they be believed in government? Will they soften? Will people, perhaps like you, who accept the majority view at the moment, perhaps argue for something softer in office? Isn't this your danger?
Well, there's always a danger that people will make things up. And the government is increasingly, in my view, looking more and more desperate. And we've seen someone like Peter Dutton, who most recently tried to intervene into the Victorian election campaign by saying that people were frightened of going out to dinner at night because of people from the African community, a very conscious and deliberate attempt to stir up disharmony in the community and division. We've seen right-wing forces throughout the world that is part of the hard right playbook. But it needs to be answered logically with rationality and arguing our case. We'll continue to do so. And I think one of the things that the Victorian election showed is that if you put your case based upon facts, if you are prepared to argue that case coherently and in a way that appeals to logic, then you can certainly win that argument. And I believe that Labor will very much win that argument in the lead up to the election campaign, whenever it's held, most likely to be May, and that a government that is increasingly looking desperate will be seen for what it is. And that's the big risk for the government, is that their over-egging and exaggeration and hyperbole on these issues runs the risk of them just looking desperate and reminding the Australian people that they've got nothing to say about education, about health, about the future of work, about infrastructure, about the sort of direction that matters to the everyday lives of the Australian people, whether they live in our cities or our regions. I think that's a risk for the government. Whether they take that risk or not, we'll wait and see.
On your side, one fear that some swinging voters would have is that a shortened government would be too close to the unions, too likely to give in to union pressure. We've mentioned the CFMEU. What is your response to that, and how important is it that a Labor government, even though the unions are part of the Labor Party or affiliated with Labor, does preserve a distance from them on some critical issues?
Well, the Labor Party is directly linked to the trade union movement. We arose out of it, and that is part of our structures. That's something that gives us contact with working people and workplaces. But that's in the context, of course, that you don't have workplaces in the private sector unless you have employers in the private sector. And that there is a common interest between successful businesses and the trade union movement and people getting work and being able to participate in the workforce. And being a worker is a precondition, obviously, for being a trade union member. So there is that common interest. One of the concerns I think that people have is that the link between a successful economy and increases in wages and working conditions has been broken in recent times. People can see that profits are up, but their wages aren't even keeping pace with inflation. They're more insecure at work. And all of those issues are issues that need to be confronted, as well as looking at where will the jobs be in the mid-half of this century? How do we train Australians for those jobs? How do we make sure that we don't import labour in the short term as a plug the holes of labour shortages which are there? And I think working with the trade union movement as well as employers can be a real plus of Labor in government, as opposed to the hostility that we've seen towards workers and unions from the government. Just a couple of examples of that is the issue of, in my area, aviation, aeronautical engineers. The average age in Australia is 57 years of age. We're seeing a massive expansion of aviation worldwide, and we're simply not training people for some of the jobs in aviation. Take shipping. In Australia, the solution, unlike other comparative nations in the OECD, is undermining under this government the capacity of Australian industry to have ships operating around the coast with the Australian flag on the back and Australian seafarers working on it. That's an area where you have a common interest of Australian industry with the Australian trade unions in the maritime sector. And the government solution is to replace those ships and those workers with ships flagged in the Philippines or third world countries, with seafarers from those countries being paid very low wages. Now, that is a vision that they have, that low wage, low skill economy. That is not one that we share in Labor. We think that in the Asian century, when we're located in the fastest growing region of the world, we have an enormous opportunity to compete, but on the basis of how smart we are, how skilled our workforce is, not in a race to the bottom. And that's why I'm very hopeful. I had a meeting just yesterday with the renewable energy sector. The opportunity for us to grow jobs, not just for Australian consumption, but as an export industry, given the natural advantages that we have in this century of sun and wind and renewable resources, which are as valuable as in the last century, some of our fossil fuel resources were important to the growth of the economy in the 20th century. In the 21st century, we need to look towards where those opportunities are for national economic growth, and that means cooperation between unions and employers, and that's something that I'm convinced that Labor will be in a much stronger position to be in than the current government.
I just want to finally brush over a few areas, just very briefly because of time. What do you think about the Greens' fortunes at this election? That you're an expert on this because they're on your tail all the time in your own electorate.
I think what we're seeing is nothing less than a schism in the Greens. I, in the past, have always spoken about the Greens' political party. I think it is very possible that this time next year we'll be speaking about the Greens' political parties. I can't see how the New South Wales Greens can survive as a single entity when you have members of Parliament. They only have eight in the Parliament, and it's split 4-4 in the New South Wales Parliament, and they're giving speeches against each other under parliamentary privilege. And quite clearly, they are dysfunctional. And they have fundamental disagreements between those people who've entered the Greens political party from the International Socialists or the Socialist Workers' Party, various far-left organisations. The Socialist Party of Australia, of course, was the former party of Lee Rhiannon. And those people who are the genuine environmentalists who've entered into the Greens Party through the environmental movement. Now, the schism that's there is massive between the two. And I think that will cause a great deal of political damage for them. Part of their brand was that unlike the major parties, they purported to be different and almost like a community movement rather than a political party. You have a member of parliament who's been pre-selected, number one on their ticket, Jeremy Buckingham, who has said that the Green structure is, to quote him, rotten and corrupt. When you have that sort of language being used in public, in private, what a number of the Greens who I know in this area are doing is resigning and walking away from the Greens political party. We've seen minor parties in the past. The Democrats, of course, most notably in recent times, rise to be in a much stronger position, frankly, than the Greens ever got to. They, of course, dissolved effectively. And I think this conflict that is going on between the two tendencies of the Greens means that we may well see, as soon as the March state election in 2019 in New South Wales, two parties essentially running against each other, trying to claim the same ground.
Now, if it's been a bad year for the Greens, it's not been a good year for the reputation of the federal parliament as a whole. Just briefly, what would a Labor government do to improve the behaviour of parliament?
Well, I think we need to restore the integrity of the parliament and to treat it with more respect.
But politicians say this all the time, and it doesn't get any better.
That is true. The issues have been ongoing. I think the issues of the replacement of elected prime ministers, the issue of the general behaviour in the parliament. One of the things that I've said consistently as well is that people need to be defined by what they're for, not just what they're against. And the tendency of if a political party comes up with a good idea, people say no automatically. That is something that we need to move away from. And all you can do as an individual politician, I think, is to try and put that into practice. And I think I've tried to do that by issues like support for the Western Sydney Airport, which would never have happened without bipartisan support. And all we can do, I guess, is through our actions, make that improvement and acknowledge that the fact is that one in three Australians aren't voting for either of the major political parties.
And people in the House, in House elections now, do seem to be attracted to these community candidates. We've got a quite big crossbench in the House. Do you think that is a desirable trend, or do you think that does, in the longer run, potentially just make governing difficult, more difficult?
Look, I support being a part of a major party because governments need cabinets to make decisions and to show leadership for the country, and that when you have non-major parties being in a position to control issues, then that can make it very difficult for governments to make the changes, sometimes of which have to be, by necessity, not populist ones. And the danger is a retreat into populism, which mightn't see the sort of economic reforms that are necessary be able to take place. I've always said that I want to be around a cabinet table making decisions, not waiting until decisions are made to decide then whether I'm going to protest in favour of them or not. And one of the other things that we've seen with multiple examples of people being elected for one political party and then joining another. And we've seen that in the Senate from, I think it's five or six people in the last just couple of years, whether it be leaving major parties like Cory Bernardi or joining major parties like Lucy Gachui, or swapping around which minor parties they belong to, such as One Nation. And we've seen that in the past as well, when One Nation in Queensland won nine seats and just disappeared. Essentially, one by one, they left. And I don't think that is positive. And I think that voters need to bear in mind that voting for an independent in a particular way doesn't mean that they necessarily will get what they think they're supporting. And I think over a period of time, if the major parties behave in a way that gains support, then people will go back to them. But they need to earn that support. And we saw that, I think, a template for that in Daniel Andrews' government, which fulfilled the commitments that they made and were able also to do some bold things. So they fulfilled their commitments to more than remove the number of level crossings they said they would do, building new schools and hospitals, which they said they would do, whilst at the same time tackling social issues such as voluntary euthanasia, opening a safe injecting room in Richmond, and they were rewarded, though, for doing what they said they'd do at the last election, and indeed minor parties such as the Greens went backwards in that election in Victoria. And I think that provides, I think, a way forward for Labor, but I think similar things could be argued for in on the coalition side, that the demise of the Newman government was because of privatisation and issues that they hadn't gone to the Australian public with. And in terms of the coalition government, I think its demise can be traced to its first budget in 2014, where there was such a reaction to the cuts to education and health and the ABC when they said very explicitly that they wouldn't do that.
And just as a last question, Anthony Albanese, if you're a minister this time next year, you will have gone into government as one of the most experienced of the Labor people, because you were spent a long time in office last time, reaching high levels. What lesson will you bring from all that experience into a new government?
I think it will be a huge advantage. The truth is that being a minister takes time to get on top of the processes. So one of the things that I'm thinking about right now is how to hit the ground running on implementing our program. I think the capacity to work with the states and territories, that is very important in terms of the COAG processes and the nature of our federation. That experience will be enhanced, and the fact of building up contacts across the sector and being able to engage in dialogue and to bring people with us on the reform process will be very important as well. So I think it is an advantage that we have, in that a range of people will have been former cabinet ministers or junior ministers, and I think that mix of that plus the new input of talent and people who've come into the parliament in recent times and who've risen through, such as Jim Chalmers and Michelle Rowland and a range of other people who'll be ministers or senior ministers for the first time, will mean that we're in a position, I think, to be a strong government. I think it will be a very good cabinet if the Australian people give us the privilege of holding those high offices at next year's election. But we'll wait and see. No one's measuring up the curtains. What we're doing is working very hard to secure the support of the Australian people. And the next few months will be critical in seeing whether the vision that we have for the country will be realised.
Anthony Albanese, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for now, but we will bring you a podcast from the ALP conference next week. And thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with you soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.